was immediately tired of the man. A thought was pushing into his head that he didn't want to allow in. He looked away from Irving to the window. Irving told him once more to think of the department before he did anything, then walked out. When he was sure Irving had made his way down the hall, Bosch lashed out with his left arm and sent the vase of daisies tumbling into the corner of the room. The vase was plastic and didn't break. The damage was just spilled water and flowers. Galvin Jr.'s ferret face momentarily poked in and then out of the room. He said nothing, but it tipped Bosch that the IAD man was posted outside in the hall. Was that for his protection? Or for the department's? Bosch didn't know. He didn't know anything anymore. Bosch pushed away an untouched tray containing an institutional meal of turkey loaf with flour gravy, corn, yams, a hard roll that was supposed to be soft, and strawberry shortcake with flat whipped cream.
"You eat that, you might never get out of here."
He looked up. It was Eleanor. She stood in the open door, smiling. He smiled back. He couldn't help himself.
"I know."
"How are you, Harry?"
"Okay. I'll be okay. Might not be able to do chin-ups anymore, but I'll survive with that. How are you, Eleanor?"
"I'm fine," she said,
and her smile just slayed him.
"They put you through the Vegematic today?"
"Oh, yeah. Sliced and diced. The best and the brightest of my fine department. A couple of your pals, too. Had me on the ropes all morning. There's a chair on this side."
She circled the bed but continued standing next to the chair. She looked around and a slight frown creased her brow, as if she knew this room and therefore knew something wasn't right.
"They got me, too, last night. They wouldn't let me come see you till they were through with you. Orders. Didn't want us going together on the story. But I guess our stories came out all right. At least they didn't pull me back in after they talked to you today. Told me that was it."
"They find the diamonds?"
"Not that I've heard. But they aren't telling me much anymore. They've got two crews working it today, but I'm out of it. I'm on a desk till it cools off and the shooting team finishes up. They're still probably at Rourke's place looking."
"What about Trown and Bin? They cooperate?"
"No. They aren't saying word one. I know that from a friend who was on the interrogation. They don't know anything about any diamonds. Probably got their own people together in a posse. They'll be out on the treasure hunt, too."
"Where do you think the treasure is?"
"I don't have any idea. This whole thing, Harry, it's kind of thrown me. I don't know what I think about things anymore."
That included what she thought about him, he knew. He didn't say anything, and after a while the silence became uneasy.
"What happened, Eleanor?"
"Irving told me Lewis and Clark intercepted Avery, but that's all I know. I don't understand."
"They watched us watch the vault all night. They must have gotten it into their heads that we were lookouts. If you start with the assumption that you were a bad cop, like they did, then you might come to the same conclusion. So when they see you turn Avery away and send the two uniforms home, they figure they know your game. They grab Avery at Darling's, and he tells them about your visit the day before and all the alarms this week, and then he lets it slip that you didn't want him to open the vault."
"And they said, 'You mean you can open the vault?' And the next thing is they're sneaking down the alley."
"Yeah. They had an idea about being heroes, catching the bad cops and the robbers all at once. Nice plan. Until the payoff."
"Poor dumb jerks."
"Poor dumb jerks."
The silence came back then, and Eleanor didn't wait for it to settle.
"Well, I just wanted to see how you were doing."
He nodded.
And to tell you..."
Here it is, he thought. The kiss goodbye.
"I decided to quit. I'm going to leave the bureau."
"What about... what will you do?"
"I don't know. But I'm going to leave here, Harry. I have some money, so I'll travel a while and then see what I want to do."
"Eleanor, why?"
"I don't... it's hard for me to explain. But everything that happened, everything about the job has turned to shit. And I don't think I can go back and work in that squad room again after what has happened."
"Will you come back to L.A.?"
She looked down at her hands and then around the room again.
I don't know. Harry, I'm sorry. It seemed like... I don't know, I'm very confused about things right now.
What things?
I don't know. Us? What's happened? Everything?
Silence filled the room again, and it seemed so loud that Bosch hoped the nurse or even Galvin Jr. would stick a head in to see if everything was all right. He needed a cigarette badly. He realized it was the first time today that he had thought about smoking. Eleanor looked down at her feet now, and he looked over at his untouched food. He picked up the roll and started to toss it up and down in his hand like a baseball. After a while, Eleanor's eyes made their third trip around the room without seeing whatever it was she was looking for. Bosch couldn't figure it out.
Didn't you get the flowers I sent?
Flowers?
Yes, I sent daisies, like the ones growing on the hill below your house. I don't see any in here.
Daisies, Bosch thought. The vase he had knocked against the wall. Where are my goddamn cigarettes, he wanted to yell. They'll probably come later. They only make deliveries up here once a day. She frowned. You know, Bosch said, if Rourke knew we'd found the second vault and were watching it, and if he knew that we watched Tron go in and clear his box, why didn't he get his people out? That really bothers me about this whole thing. Why'd he go through with it? She shook her head slowly.
I don't know. Maybe... Well, I've been thinking that maybe he wanted them to go down. He knew those guys. Maybe he knew it would work out that they'd go down shooting, that without them he'd get to keep all the diamonds from the first vault.
Yeah. But you know, I've been remembering things all day, about when we were down there. It's been coming back, and I remember that he didn't say he'd get it all. He said something about his share being bigger now with Meadows and the other two dead. He still used the word share, like there was still someone else to split it with. She raised her eyebrows.
Maybe, but it's just semantics, Harry.
Maybe.
I've got to go. You know how long they'll keep you?
Haven't been told, but I think tomorrow I'll take myself out. Thinking about going to Meadows' funeral over at Veterans.
A Memorial Day funeral. Sounds appropriate to me.
Want to go with me?
No. I don't think I want anything more to do with Mr. Meadows. But I'll be at the bureau tomorrow, clearing out my desk and writing up status sheets on the cases I'll have to pass to other agents. You could come by if you'd like. I'll brew you some fresh coffee like before. But, you know, I don't really think they're going to let you out so fast, Harry. Not with a bullet wound. You need to rest. You need to heal some.
Sure, Bosch said. He knew she was saying goodbye to him.
Okay, then. Maybe I'll see you.
She leaned over and kissed him goodbye, and he knew it was goodbye to everything about them. She was almost out the door before he opened his eyes.
One last thing, he said, and she turned at the door and looked back at him.
How'd you find me, Eleanor? You know, in the tunnels with Rourke. She hesitated, and her eyebrows went up again.
Well, I went down with Hanlon, but when we got out of the hand-dug tunnel, we split up. He went one way in that first line, and I went the other. I picked the winner. I found the blood. Then I found Franklin, dead, and after that I was a little lucky. I heard the shots and then the voices, mostly Rourke's voice. I followed that. Why did you think of that now?
I don't know. Just sort of came up. You saved my life. They looked at each other. Her hand was on the door handle, and it was open just enough so that Bosch could look past her and see Galvin Jr. still there, sitting in a chair in the hallway. All I can say is thanks. She made a shushing sound, dismissing his gratitude.
You don't have to say anything.
Don't quit. He saw the crack in the door disappear, Junior with it. She stood there silently. Don't leave.
I must. I'll see you, Harry.
She pulled the door all the way open now.
Goodbye,
she said. And then she was gone. Bosch remained motionless on the hospital bed for the better part of an hour. He was thinking about two people, Eleanor Wish and John Rourke. For a long time he closed his eyes and dwelt on the look on Rourke's face as he crumpled and went down into the black water. I'd be surprised too, Bosch thought. But there was also something else there, something he couldn't exactly identify, some kind of knowing look of recognition and resolution, not of his dying, but of another, secret knowledge. After a while he got up and took a few tentative steps alongside his bed. His body felt weak, yet all the sleep in the last 36 hours had made him restless. After he got his bearings and his shoulder made a slightly painful adjustment to gravity, he began to pace back and forth alongside the bed. He was wearing pale green hospital pajamas, not one of the opened back smocks that he would have found humiliating. He padded around the room in bare feet, stopping to read the cards that had come with the flowers. The Protective League had sent one of the vases. The others came from a couple of cops he knew but wasn't particularly close to, the widow of an old partner, his union lawyer, and another old partner who lived in Ensenada. He walked away from the flowers and went to the door. He opened it a crack and saw Galvin Jr. still sitting there, reading a police equipment catalog. Bosch pulled the door all the way open. Galvin's head jerked up, and he slapped the magazine closed and slipped it into a briefcase at his feet. He didn't say anything. "So, Clifford, I hope I can call you that. What are you doing here? Am I supposed to be in danger?" The younger cop didn't say anything. Bosch glanced up and down the hall and saw that it was empty all the way down to the nurse's station, about 50 feet away. He looked at his door and noticed he was in room 313.
"Detective, please go back in your room," Galvin finally said. "I'm only here to keep the press out of your room. The deputy chief thinks they'll probably try to get in to get an interview with you, and my job is to prevent that, to prevent you from being disturbed."
What if they use the sneaky method of just... Bosch made a show of looking up and down the hall to make sure no one would hear. Using the telephone. Galvin exhaled loudly and continued not to look at Bosch.
"The nurses are screening incoming calls. Only family, and I'm told you don't have family, so no calls."
"How'd that lady FBI agent get by you?"
"She was cleared by Irving. Go back into your room, please."
"Certainly." Bosch sat on his bed and tried to go over the case again in his mind. But the more he turned the parts of it over, the more he got an anxious feeling that sitting on a bed in a hospital room was wasting time. He felt he was onto something, a breakthrough in the logic of the case. A detective's job was to walk down the trail of evidence, examine each piece, and take it with him. At the end of the trail, what he had in his basket made or lost the case. Bosch had a full basket, but he began to believe there were pieces missing. What had he missed? What had Rourke told him at the end? Not so much in his words, but his meaning, and the look on his face. Surprise. But surprise at what? Was he shocked at the bullet, or shocked by where and who it came from? It could have been both, Bosch decided, and either way, what did it mean? Rourke's reference to his share growing larger because of the death of Meadows, Franklin, and Delgado continued to bother him. He tried to put himself in Rourke's position. If all his partners were dead and he was suddenly the sole beneficiary of the first vault caper, would he say, "My share has gone up," or would he simply say, "It's all mine"? Bosch's gut feeling was he would say the latter, unless there was still someone else sharing in the pot. He decided he had to do something. He had to get out of this room. He was not under house arrest, but he knew that if he left, Galvin was there to follow and report to Irving. He checked the phone and found that it had been turned on as Irving promised. No calls in, but Harry could call out. He got up and checked the closet. His clothes were there, what was left of them. Shoes, socks, and pants. That was it. The pants had abrasion marks on the knees, but had been cleaned and pressed by the hospital. His sports coat and shirt had probably been taken off with scissors in the ER and either thrown away or put in an evidence bag. He grabbed all the clothing and got dressed, tucking his pajama top into his pants when he was done. He looked cloddish, but it would do until he got some clothes on the outside. The pain in his shoulder was least when he held his arm up in front of his chest, so he began to put his belt around his shoulders to use it as a sling, but deciding that would make him too noticeable going out of the hospital, he put the belt back through the loops of his pants. He checked the drawer of the nightstand and found his wallet and badge, but no gun. When he was ready, he picked up the phone on the bedside table, dialed the operator, and asked for the third-floor nursing station. A woman's voice said, "Hello," and Bosch identified himself as Deputy Chief Irvin Irving. "Can you get Detective Galvin, my man on the chair down the hall, to come to the phone? I need to speak with him." Bosch put the phone down on the bed and walked softly to the door. He opened it just wide enough to see Galvin sitting on the chair reading the catalog again. Bosch heard the nurse's voice calling him to the phone, and Galvin got up. Bosch waited about 10 seconds before looking down the hall. Galvin was still walking toward the nurse's station. Bosch stepped out of the room and began walking quietly the opposite way. After 10 yards, there was an intersection of hallways, and Bosch took a left. He came to an elevator with a sign above it that said, "Hospital Personnel Only," and he punched the button. When it came, it was a stainless steel and fake wood grain affair with another set of doors at the back, big enough for at least 2 beds to be wheeled in. He pushed the first floor button, and the door closed. His treatment for the bullet wound had ended. The elevator dropped Bosch off in the emergency room. He walked through and out into the night. On the way to Hollywood Station in a cab, he had the driver stop at his bank, where he got money out of an ATM, and then at a Savon drugstore, where he bought a cheap sport shirt, a carton of cigarettes, a lighter, since he couldn't handle matches, and some cotton, fresh bandages, and a sling. The sling was navy blue. It would be perfect for a funeral. He paid the cab driver at the station on Wilcox and went in through the front door, where he knew there was less chance that he would be recognized or spoken to. There was a rookie he didn't know on the front desk with the same pimple-faced explorer scout who had brought the pizza to Sharkey. Bosch held up his badge and passed by without saying a word. The detective bureau was dark and deserted, as it was on most Sunday nights, even in Hollywood. Bosch had a desk light clamped to his spot at the homicide table. He turned it on, rather than using the bureau's ceiling lights, which might draw curious patrol officers down the hall from the watch commander's office. Harry didn't feel like answering questions, even the well-meaning ones from the uniformed troops. He first went to the back of the room and started a pot of coffee, then he went into one of the interview rooms to change into his new shirt. His shoulders sent arrows of searing pain through his chest and down his arm as he pulled the hospital shirt off. He sat down in one of the chairs and examined the bandage for signs of a blood leak. There was none. Carefully, and much less painfully, he slipped the new shirt on. It was extra large. There was a small drawing of a mountain, sun, and seascape on the left breast, and the words, "City of Angels." Bosch covered that when he put on the sling and adjusted it so that it held his arm tightly against his chest. The coffee was ready when he was finished changing. He carried a steaming cup to the homicide table, lit a cigarette, and pulled the murder book and other files on the Meadows case out of a file drawer. He looked at the pile and didn't know where to start or what he was looking for. He began reading through it all, hoping something would hit him as being wrong. He was looking for anything. A new name, a discrepancy in somebody's statement, something that had been discarded earlier as unimportant, but would look different to him now. He quickly scanned his own reports, because most of the information he could still recall. Then he reread Meadows' military file. It was the slimmer version, the FBI handout. He had no idea what had happened to the more detailed records he had received from St. Louis and had left in the car when he went running toward the vault the morning before. He realized then that he had no idea where that car was, either. Bosch drew a blank on the military file. While he was looking down at the miscellaneous paperwork in the back of the binder, the ceiling lights came on, and an old beat cop named Peterson came in. He was heading toward one of the typewriters with an arrest report in his hand and didn't notice Bosch until he had sat down. He looked around when he smelled the cigarettes and coffee and saw the detective with the sling.
"Harry, how goes it? They let you out quick. Word around here was that you were righteously fucked up."
Just a scratch, Beads. You get it worse from the fingernails of the he-shes you pull in every Saturday night. At least with a bullet, you don't have to worry about the AIDS shit.
You're telling me.
Peterson instinctively massaged his neck, where he still had scars from scratches inflicted by a transvestite hooker infected with the HIV virus. The old beat cop had sweated out 2 years of testing every 3 months, but didn't get the virus. It was a story that was nightmarish legend in the division, and probably the single reason the average occupancy in the TV and prostitute tanks at the station jail had dropped by half since then. Nobody wanted to arrest them anymore, unless it was for murder.
Anyway, Peterson said, sorry it went to shit out there, Harry. I heard the second cop went code 7 a little while ago. Two cops and a Phoebe down in one shootout? Not to mention you getting your arm all fucked up? Probably some kind of a record for this town. Mind if I have a cup?
Bosch gestured to the coffee pot. He hadn't heard that Clark had died. Code 7. Out of service. For good. He still couldn't bring himself to feel sorry for the two IAD cops, and that made him feel sorry for himself. Made him feel like the hardening of the heart was now complete. He no longer had compassion for anybody, not even poor, dumb jerks who screwed up and got themselves killed.
They don't tell you shit around here, Peterson was saying as he poured. But when I read those names in the paper, I said, whoa, I know them guys, Lewis and Clark. They were IAD, not on any bank detail. They called them two the great explorers, always digging around looking to fuck somebody up. I think everybody knows that's who they were, but the TV and the Times... Anyway, that sure was curious, you know, what they were doing there.
Bosch wasn't going to bite on that. Peterson and the other cops would have to find out from another source what really went down at Beverly Hills Safe and Lock. In fact, he began to wonder if Peterson really had an arrest report to type up, or had the rookie at the front desk spread the word that Bosch was in the bureau and the old beat cop had been sent back to pump him. Peterson had hair whiter than chalk and was considered an old cop, but was actually only a few years older than Bosch. He had walked or driven the boulevard beat for 20 years on night watch, and that was enough to turn a man's hair white early. Bosch liked Peterson. He was a silo of information about the street. There was rarely a murder on the boulevard that went by without Bosch's checking with him to see what his informants were saying, and he almost always came through.
Yeah, it's curious, Bosch said. He added nothing else.
You doing paper from your shooting?
Peterson asked after settling himself in front of a typewriter. When Bosch didn't answer, he added,
you got any more of those cigarettes?
Bosch got up and carried a whole pack over to Peterson. He put them down on the typewriter in front of the beat cop and told him they were his. Peterson got the message. Nothing personal, but Bosch wasn't going to talk about the shootout, especially about what a couple of IAD cops were doing there. Peterson got to work on the typewriter after that, and Bosch went back to his murder book. He finished reading through it without a single 40-watt bulb lighting up in his head. He sat there with the typewriter clacking in the background and smoked and tried to think of what else there was to do. There was nothing. He was at the wall. He decided to call his home and check the tape machine. He picked up his phone, then thought better of using it, and hung up. On the off chance his desk phone wasn't a private line, he walked around to Jerry Edgar's spot at the table and used his line. He got his answering machine, punched in a code, and listened as it played a dozen messages. The first 9 were from cops and some old friends wishing him a speedy recovery. The last 3, the most recent messages, were from the doctor who had been treating him, Irving, and Pounds.
Mr. Bosch, this is Dr. McKenna. I consider it very unwise and unsafe for you to have left the hospital environment. You are risking further damage to your body. If you get this message, would you please return to the hospital? We are holding the bed. I can no longer treat you or consider you my patient if you do not return. Please. Thank you.
Irving and Pounds were not as worried about Bosch's health. Irving's message said,
I do not know where you are or what you are doing, but it better be that you just do not like hospital food. Think about what I told you, Detective Bosch. Do not make a mistake we will both be sorry for.
Irving hadn't bothered to identify himself, but didn't have to. Neither did Pounds. His message was the last. It was the chorus.
Bosch, call me at home as soon as you get this. I have received word that you left the hospital, and we need to talk. Bosch, you are not, repeat, not to continue any line of investigation relating to the shootings on Saturday. Call me.
Bosch hung up. He wasn't going to call any of them. Not yet. While sitting at Edgar's spot, he noticed a scratch pad on the table on which the name Veronica Niece was written, Sharkey's mother. There was also a phone number. Edgar must have called her to notify her about her son's death. Bosch thought of her answering the call, expecting it to be another one of her jerk-off customers, and instead it was Jerry Edgar calling to say her son was dead. His thought of the boy reminded Bosch of the interview. He had not had the tape transcribed yet. He decided to listen to it and went back to his place at the table. He pulled his tape recorder out of a drawer. The tape was gone. He remembered he had given it to Eleanor. He went to the supply closet, trying to calculate whether the interview would still be on the backup tape. The backup automatically rewound when it reached its end and then started taping over itself. Depending on how often the taping system in the interview room had been used since Tuesday's session with Sharkey, the Q&A with the boy might still be intact on the backup tape. Bosch popped the cassette out of the recorder and brought it back to his table. He put it in his own portable, put on a set of earphones, and rewound the tape to its beginning. He reviewed it by playing it for a few seconds until he could tell whether it was his voice or Sharkey's or Eleanor's, and then fast-forwarding for about 10 seconds. He repeated this process for several minutes before he finally hit the Sharkey interview in the last half of the tape. Once he found it, he rewound the tape a bit so he could hear the interview from the start. He rewound too far and ended up listening to half a minute of another interview concluding. Then he heard Sharkey's voice addressing Eleanor.
What are you looking at? I don't know. I was wondering if you knew me. You seem familiar. I didn't realize I was staring. What? Why should I know you? I never did no federal shit, man. I don't know. Never mind. You looked familiar to me, that's all. I was wondering if you recognized me. Why don't we wait until Detective Bosch comes in? Yeah, okay. Cool.
There was silence on the tape then. Listening to it, Bosch was confused. Then he realized that what he had just heard had been said before he went into the interview room. What had she been doing? The silence on the tape ended, and Bosch heard his own voice.
Sharkey, we're going to tape this because it might help us later to go over it. Like I said, you are not a suspect, so...
Bosch stopped the tape and rewound it to the exchange between the boy and Eleanor. He listened to it again, and then again. Each time it felt as if he had been punched in the heart. His hands were sweating, and his fingers slipped on the buttons of the recorder. He finally pulled the earphones off and flung them onto the table. "Damn it," he said. Peterson stopped typing and looked over. Part 9. Monday, May 28th. Memorial Day observed. By the time Bosch got to the Veterans Cemetery in Westwood, it was just after midnight. He had checked a new car out of the Wilcox Fleet garage and then driven by Eleanor Wish's apartment. There were no lights on, and he felt like a teenager checking on the girlfriend who dumped him. Even though he was alone, he was embarrassed. He didn't know what he would have done if there had been a light. He headed back east toward the cemetery, thinking about Eleanor and how she had betrayed him in love and business all at the same time. He started with the supposition that Eleanor had asked Sharkey if he recognized her because it was she who had been in the jeep that delivered Meadows' body to the reservoir. She had been looking for a sign that the boy realized this and recognized her, but he didn't. Sharkey went on, after Bosch joined the interview, to say he had seen two people who he thought were men. He said the smaller of the two stayed in the jeep's passenger seat and didn't help with the body at all. It seemed to Bosch that the boy's mistake should have ensured his life, but he knew that it had been he who had then doomed Sharkey when he suggested hypnotizing him. Eleanor had passed that on to Rourke, who knew he couldn't risk it. Next was the question of why. The money was the ultimate answer, but Bosch could not comfortably attribute this motive to Eleanor. There was something more. The others involved, Meadows, Franklin, Delgado, and Rourke all shared the common bond of Vietnam as well as direct knowledge of the two targets, Bin and Tran. How did Eleanor fit into this? Bosch thought about her brother, killed in Vietnam. Was he the connection? He remembered that she had said his name was Michael, but she hadn't mentioned how or when he was killed. Bosch hadn't let her. Now he regretted having stopped her when she apparently wanted to talk about him. She had mentioned the memorial in Washington and how it had changed her. What could she have seen that would do that? What could the wall have told her that she didn't already know? He drove into the cemetery off Sepulveda Boulevard and up to the great black iron gates that stood closed across the gravel entrance road. Bosch got out and walked up, but they were locked with a chain and padlock. He looked through the black bars and saw a small stone block house about 30 yards up the gravel road. He saw the pale blue glow of TV light against a curtained window. Bosch went back to the car and flipped the siren. He let it wail until a light came on behind the curtain. The cemetery attendant came out a few moments later and walked toward the gate with a flashlight while Bosch got his badge case out and held it open through the bars. The man wore dark pants and a light blue shirt with a tin badge on it.
"You police?"
he asked. Bosch felt like saying,
"No, Amway."
Instead, he said, "LAPD, I wonder if you can open her up for me." The attendant put the flashlight on his badge and ID. In the light, Bosch could see the white whiskers on the man's face and smell the slight scent of bourbon and sweat.
"What's the problem, officer?"
"Detective, I'm on a homicide investigation, Mr.
Kester."
"Homicide? We got plenty dead people here, but these cases are closed, I guess you could say." "Mr. Kester, I don't have time to go through all the details, but what I need to do is take a look at the Vietnam Memorial, the replica that's on display here for the holiday weekend."
"What's wrong with your arm? And where's your partner? Don't you guys travel in twos?"
"I was hurt, Mr. Kester. My partner is working on another part of the investigation. You watch too much TV in that little room of yours. That's TV cops stuff." Bosch said this last part with a smile, but he was already getting tired of the old security guard. Kester turned and looked at the cemetery house and then back at Bosch.
"You seen the TV light, right? I figured that one. This is federal property, and I don't know if I can open it up with a..."
"Look, Kester, I know you're civil service, and they haven't fired anyone since maybe Truman was president. But if you give me a bad time on this, I'm going to give you a bad time. I'll put a drinking on the job beef in on you Tuesday morning, first thing. Now let's do it. Open it up, and I won't bother you. I just need to take a look at the wall." Bosch rattled the chain. Kester stared dull-eyed at the lock and then fished a ring of keys off his belt and opened the gate. "Sorry," Bosch said.
"I still don't think this is proper," Kester said angrily. "What's that black stone got to do with a homicide anyway?"
"Maybe everything," Bosch said. He started walking back to his car but then turned around, remembering something he had read about the memorial.
"There's a book. It tells where the names are on the wall. You can look them up. Is that up there at the wall?"
Kester had a puzzled look on his face that Bosch could see even in the dark. He said,
"Don't know about any book. All I know is that the U.S. Park Service people brought that thing in here, set it up, took a bulldozer to clear a spot on the hill. They got some guy that stays with it during proper visiting hours. He's the one you'll have to ask about books, and don't ask me where he is. I don't even know his name. You gonna be a while, or should I leave it unlocked?"
"Better lock it up. I'll come get you when I'm leaving." He drove the car through the gate after the old man pulled it open, then up to a gravel parking area near the hill. Bosch could see the dark shine of the wall in the gash carved out of the rise. There were no lights, and the area was deserted. He took a flashlight off the car seat and headed up the slope. He first swung the light around to get an idea of the wall's size. It was about 60 feet long, tapering at each end. Then he walked up close enough to read the names. An unexpected feeling came over him, a dread. He did not want to see these names, he realized. There would be too many that he knew. And what was worse was that he might come across names he didn't expect, that belonged to men he didn't know were here. He swept the beam around and saw a wooden lectern, its top canted and ledged to hold a book, like a church Bible stand. But when he walked over, he found nothing on the stand. The Park Service people must have taken the directory with them for safekeeping. Bosch turned and looked back at the wall, its far end tapering off into darkness. He checked his cigarettes and saw he had nearly a whole pack. He admitted to himself that he had expected it would be this way. He would have to read every name. He knew it before he came. He lit a cigarette and put the beam on the first panel of the wall. It was 4 hours before he saw a name he recognized. It wasn't Michael Scarletti. It was Darius Coleman, a boy Bosch had known from 1st Infantry. Coleman was the first guy Bosch had known, really known, to get blown away. Everybody had called him Cake. He had a knife-cut tattoo on his forearm that said Cake, and he was killed by friendly fire when a 22-year-old lieutenant called in the wrong chart coordinates for an airstrike in the Triangle. Bosch reached to the wall and ran his fingers along the letters in the dead soldier's name. He had seen people do that on TV and in movies. He pictured Cake, with a reefer tucked behind his ear, sitting on his pack and eating chocolate cake out of a can. He was always trading for everybody's cake. The reefer made him crave the chocolate. Harry moved on to other names after that, stopping only to light cigarettes until he had none left. In nearly 4 more hours, he had come across 3 dozen more names belonging to soldiers he had known and knew were dead. There were no surprise names, and so his fear in that regard was unfounded. But despair came from something else. A small picture of a man in uniform was wedged into the thin crack between the false marble panels of the memorial. The man offered his full, proud smile to the world. Now he was a name on the wall. Bosch held the photo in his hand and turned it over. It said, "George, we miss your smile. All our love, Mom and Terry." Bosch carefully put the photo back into the crack, feeling like an intruder on something very private. He thought about George, a man he never knew, and grew sad for no reason he could explain to himself. After a while, he moved on. At the end, after 58,132 names, there was one he had not seen. Michael Scarletti. It was what he had expected. Bosch looked up at the sky. It was turning orange in the east, and he could feel a slight breeze coming out of the northwest. To the south, the federal building loomed above the cemetery tree line like a giant, dark tombstone. Bosch was lost. He didn't know why he was here, or whether what he had found meant a damned thing. Was Michael Scarletti still alive? Had he ever existed? What Eleanor had said about her trip to the memorial had seemed so real and true. How could any of this make sense? The beam of the flashlight was weak and dying. He turned it off. Bosch napped a couple of hours in his car at the cemetery. When he woke, the sun was high in the sky, and for the first time he noticed that the cemetery lawns were awash in flags, each grave marked by a small plastic Old Glory on a wooden stick. He started the car and slowly made his way along the thin cemetery roads, looking for the spot where Meadows would be buried. It wasn't hard to find. Nestled on the side of one of the roads that wound into the northeast section of the cemetery were 4 vans with microwave antennas. There was a grouping of other cars as well. The media. Bosch hadn't expected all of the TV cameras and the reporters, but once he saw this crowd, he realized that he had forgotten that holidays were slow news days, and the tunnel caper, as it had been dubbed by the media, was still a hot item. The video vampires would need fresh footage for the evening's broadcasts. He decided to stay in the car and watched as the short ceremony at Meadows' gray casket was filmed in quadruplicate. It was presided over by a rumpled minister who probably came from one of the downtown missions. There were no real mourners, except for a few professionals from the VFW. A 3-man honor guard also stood at attention. When it was over, the minister pushed the brake pedal with his foot, and the casket slowly descended. The cameras came in tight on this. And then, afterward, The news teams broke off in different directions to film stand-up reports at locations around the gravesite. They were spread out in a semicircle. This way, each reporter would look as if he or she had been at the funeral exclusively. Bosch recognized a few as people who had shoved microphones in his face before. Then he noticed that one of the men he had thought was one of the professional mourners was actually Bremer. The Times reporter walked away from the grave and was heading to one of the cars parked along the access road. Bosch waited until Bremer was almost next to his car before he rolled down the window and called to him.
Harry, I thought you were in the hospital or something.
I thought I'd come by, but I didn't know it was going to be a circus. Don't you people have anything better to do?
Hey, I'm not with them. That's a pig fuck.
What?
TV reporters. That's what they call one of these gangbangs. So, what are you doing here? I didn't think you'd be out so soon.
I escaped. Why don't you get in and take a ride? Then, indicating the TV reporters with his hand, Bosch said, they might see me here and charge over and trample us. Bremer walked around and got in the car. Bosch took the driveway to the west section of the cemetery. He parked under the shade of a sprawling oak tree, from which they could see the Vietnam Memorial. There were several people milling about, mostly men, mostly alone. They all looked at the black stone quietly. A couple of the men wore old fatigue jackets, the sleeves cut off.
You seen the papers or TV yet on this thing?
Bremer asked.
Not yet, but I heard what was put out.
And?
Bullshit. Most of it, at least. Can you tell me?
Not that it gets back to me. Bremer nodded. They had known each other a long time. Bosch did not have to ask for promises, and Bremer did not have to go over the differences between off-the-record statements, background statements, and statements not for attribution. They had a trust built on prior credibility, going both ways. Three things you should check, Bosch said. Nobody's asked about Lewis and Clark. They weren't part of my surveillance. They were working for Irving over at IAD. So once you get that established, put the heat on them to explain what they were doing.
What were they doing?
That you'll have to get somewhere else. I know you have other sources in the department. Bremer was writing in a long, thin spiral notebook, the kind that always gave reporters away. He was nodding as he wrote. Second, find out about Rourke's funeral. It'll probably be out of state somewhere, someplace far enough away that the media back here won't bother to send anybody. But send somebody anyway, somebody with a camera. He'll probably be the only one there. Just like today's planting. That should tell you something. Bremer looked up from his notebook.
You mean no hero's funeral? You're saying Rourke was part of this thing, or he just fucked it up? Christ, the Bureau and we, the media, are making the guy out to be John Wayne reincarnated. Yeah, well, you gave him life after death. You can take it away, I guess.
Bosch just looked at him a moment, contemplating how much he should tell. What was safe for him to tell. For just a moment, he felt so outraged, he wanted to tell Bremer everything he knew, and the hell with what would happen and what Irving had said. But he didn't. Control came back.
What's the third thing?
Bremer asked. Get the military records of Meadows, Rourke, Franklin, and Delgado. That'll tie it up for you. They were in Vietnam, same time, same unit. That's where this whole thing starts. When you get that far, call me and I'll try to fill in what you don't have. Then, all at once, Bosch grew tired of the charade being orchestrated by his department and the FBI. The thought of the boy, Sharky, kept coming to mind. Flat on his back, his head cocked at that odd, sickening angle, the blood. They were going to mop that one up like it didn't matter. There's a fourth thing, he said. There was a kid. When the story about Sharky was finished, Bosch started the car and drove Bremer back down the driveway to his own car. The TV reporters had cleared out of the cemetery, and a man in a small front loader was pushing dirt into Meadows' grave. Another man leaned on a shovel nearby and watched.
"I'll probably need a job after your story comes out," Bosch said while watching the gravediggers. "You won't be in it as an attribution. Plus, when I get the military records, they'll speak for themselves. I'll be able to scam the department's public information officers into confirming some of this other stuff, make it look like it came from them. And then, near the bottom of the story, I'll say, Detective Harry Bosch declined comment. How's that?
I'll probably need a job after your story comes out. Bremer just looked at the detective for a long moment.
Are you going over to the grave?
I might, after you leave me alone.
I'm leaving.
He opened the car door and got out, then leaned back in.
Thanks, Harry. This is going to be a good one. Heads are going to bounce.
Bosch looked at the reporter and sadly shook his head.
No, they aren't, he said.
Bremer stared uneasily, and Bosch dismissed him with his hand. The reporter closed the door and went to his own car. Bosch had no misconceived notion about Bremer. The reporter was not guided by any genuine sense of outrage or by his role as a watchdog for the public. All he wanted was a story no other reporter had. Bremer was thinking of that, and maybe the book that would come after, and the TV movie and the money and ego-feeding fame. That was what motivated him, not the outrage that had made Bosch tell him the story. Bosch knew this and accepted it. It was the way things worked.
Heads never bounce, he said to himself.
He watched the gravediggers finish their job. After a while, he got out and walked over. There was one small bouquet of flowers next to the flag stuck in the soft orange ground. The flowers were from the VFW. Bosch stared at the scene and didn't know what he should feel. Maybe some kind of sentimental affection or remorse. Meadows was underground for good this time. Bosch didn't feel a thing. After a while, he looked up from the grave and toward the federal building. He started walking in that direction. He felt like a ghost coming from the grave for justice, or maybe just vengeance. If she was surprised it was Bosch who had pressed the door buzzer, Eleanor Wish didn't show it. Harry had flipped his badge to the guard on the first floor and been waved to the elevator. There was no receptionist working on the holiday, so he had pressed the night bell. It was Eleanor who opened the door. She wore faded jeans and a white blouse. There was no gun on her belt.
I thought you might come, Harry. Were you at the funeral?
He nodded, but made no move toward the door she held open. She looked at him a long moment, her eyebrows arched in that lovely, questioning look she had.
Well, are you going to come in or stand out there all day?
I was thinking we would take a walk. Talk alone.
I have to get my key card so I can come back in.
She made a move to go back in and then stopped.
I doubt you heard this because they haven't put the word out, but they found the diamonds.
What?
Yes. They traced Rourke to some public storage lockers in Huntington Beach. They found receipts somewhere. They got the court order this morning and just opened them. I've been listening to the scanner. They're saying hundreds of diamonds. They'll have to get an appraiser. We were right, Harry. Diamonds. You were right. They also found all the other stuff in a second locker. Rourke hadn't got rid of it. The box holders will get their stuff back. There's going to be a press conference, but I doubt they'll be saying whose lockers they were.
He just nodded, and she disappeared through the door. Bosch wandered over to the elevators and pushed the button while waiting for her. She had her purse with her when she came out. It made him conscious of not having a gun, and it privately embarrassed him that he momentarily thought that was a concern. They didn't speak on the way down, not until they were out of the building and on the sidewalk, heading toward Wilshire. Bosch had been weighing his words, wondering if the finding of the diamonds meant anything. She seemed to be waiting for him to begin, but uncomfortable in the silence.
I like the blue sling, she finally said. How do you feel, anyway? I'm surprised they let you out of there so soon.
I just left.
I feel fine.
He stopped to put a cigarette in his mouth. He had bought a pack from a machine in the lobby. He lit it with the lighter.
You know, she said, this would be a good time to quit those. Make a new start?
He ignored the suggestion and breathed the smoke in deeply.
Eleanor, tell me about your brother.
My brother? I told you.
I know, I want to hear again. About what happened to him and what happened when you visited the wall in Washington. You said it changed things for you. Why did it change things for you?
They were at Wilshire. Bosch pointed across the street, and they crossed toward the cemetery. I left my car over here. I'll drive you back.
I don't like cemeteries, I told you.
Who does? They walked through the opening in the hedge, and the sound of traffic was quieted. Before them was the expanse of green lawn, white stones, and American flags.
My story's the same as a thousand others, she said. My brother went over there and didn't come back, that's all. And then, you know, going to the memorial, but it filled me with a lot of different feelings.
Anger?
Yes, there was that.
Outrage?
Yes, I guess, I don't know. It was very personal. What's going on, Harry? What has this got to do with anything?
They were on the gravel drive that ran alongside the rows of white stone. Bosch was leading her toward the replica. You said your father was career military. Did you get the details of what happened to your brother?
He did, but he and my mother never really said anything to me about details. I mean, they just said he was coming home soon, and I had gotten a letter from him saying he was coming. Then, like the next week, you know, they said he had been killed. He didn't make it home after all. Harry, you're making me feel... What do you want? I don't understand this.
Sure you do, Eleanor. She stopped and just looked down at the ground. Bosch saw the color in her face change to a lighter shade of pale, and her expression became one of resignation. It was subtle, but it was there, like the faces of mothers and wives he had seen while making next-of-kin notification. You didn't have to tell them somebody was dead. They opened the door, they knew the score. And now Eleanor's face showed that she knew Bosch had her secret. She lifted her eyes and looked off, away from him. Her gaze settled on the black memorial gleaming in the sun at the top of the rise.
That's it, isn't it? You brought me here to see that.
I guess I could ask you to show me where your brother's name is, but we both know it's not on there.
No, it's not.
She was transfixed by the sight of the memorial. Bosch could see in her face that the hard shell resistance was gone. The secret wanted to come out. So tell me about it, he said.
I did have a brother, and he died. I never lied to you, Harry. I never actually said he was killed over there. I said he never came back, and he didn't. That is true. But he died here in L.A. on his way home. It was 1973.
She seemed to go off on a memory. Then she came back.
Amazing. I mean, to make it through that war and then to not make the trip home, it doesn't make sense. He had a 2-day layover in L.A. on the way back to D.C. to the hero's welcome we were going to have for him. There was a nice, safe job arranged through father at the Pentagon. Only they found him in a brothel in Hollywood. The spike was still in his arm. Heroin.
She looked up at Bosch's face and then looked away.
That's the way it looked, but that wasn't the way it was. It was ruled an OD, but he was murdered, just like Meadows so many years later. But my brother was written off the way Meadows was supposed to have been written off.
Bosch thought she might be beginning to cry. He needed to keep her on track, telling the story. What's going on, Eleanor? What's it got to do with Meadows?
Nothing,
she said, and looked back along the trail they had walked. Now she was lying. He knew there was something. He had the dreadful feeling in his gut that the whole thing revolved around her. He thought of the daisies she had sent to his hospital room, the music they had played at her apartment, the way she had found him in the tunnel. Too many coincidences. Everything, he said. It was all part of your plan.
No, Harry.
Eleanor, how did you know there are daisies growing on the hill below my house?
I saw them when I...
You visited me at night, remember? You couldn't see anything below the porch. He let that sink in a little. You had been there before, Eleanor, when I was taking care of Sharky. And then the visit later that night, that wasn't a visit, that was a test. Like the hang-up phone call, that was you. Because it was you who put the bug in my phone. This whole thing was... Why don't you just tell me? She nodded without looking at him. He could not take his eyes off her. She composed herself and began.
Did you ever have one thing that was at your center, was the very seed of your existence? Everybody has one unalterable truth at their core. For me, it was my brother. My brother and his sacrifice. That's how I dealt with his death. By making it and him larger than life, making him a hero. It was the seed that I protected and nurtured. I built a hard shell around it and watered it with my adoration. And as it grew, it became a bigger part of me. It grew into the tree that shaded my life. Then all of a sudden, one day it was gone. The truth was false. The tree was chopped down, Harry. No more shade. Just the blinding sun.
She was quiet a moment, and Bosch studied her. She seemed all at once to be so fragile he wanted to rush her to a chair before she collapsed. She cupped one elbow with her hand and held the other hand to her lips. It dawned on him what she was saying.
You didn't know, did you?
Bosch said.
Your parents?
Nobody told you the truth. She nodded.
I grew up thinking he was the hero my mother and father told me he was. They shielded me. They lied. But how could they know that one day a monument would be made and they would put every name on it? Every name but my brother's.
She stopped, but this time he waited her out.
One day, a few years ago, I went to the memorial. I thought there was some kind of mistake. There was a book there, an index of the names, and I looked, and he wasn't listed. No Michael Scarletti. I yelled at the Parks people, how could you just leave someone's name out of the book? And so I spent the rest of the day reading the names on the wall. All of them. I was going to show them how wrong they were. But he wasn't there either. I couldn't... Do you know what it's like to spend almost 15 years of your life believing something? To build your beliefs around one single shining fact and have... To find that all that time actually was like cancer growing inside?
Bosch smeared the tears on her cheeks with his hand. He leaned his face close to hers. So what did you do, Eleanor? The fist against her lips squeezed tighter, her knuckles as bloodless as a corpse's. Bosch noticed a park bench farther down the walkway, and he took her by the shoulder and directed her there. This whole thing, he said, after they were sitting. I don't understand, Eleanor, this whole thing. You wanted some kind of revenge against
justice. Not revenge, not vengeance.
Is there a difference? She didn't answer. Tell me what you did.
I confronted my parents, and they finally told me about L.A. I went through all my things from him, and I found a letter. His last letter. I still had it in my things at my parents' house, but I'd forgotten it. It's here.
She opened her purse and pulled out her wallet. Bosch could see the rubber grips and the handle of her gun in the purse. She opened her wallet and pulled out a twice-folded piece of lined notebook paper. She delicately unfolded it and held it open for him to read. He didn't touch it. Ellie, I'm getting so short here I can practically taste the soft-shell crabs. I should be home in 2 weeks or so. First, I have to stop off in Los Angeles to make some money.
Ha-ha.
I have a plan, but don't tell the OM. I'm supposed to drop off a diplomatic package in L.A., but there might be a way to do something better with it. When I get back, maybe we can go up to the Poconos again before I have to go back to work for the war machine. I know what you think about what I'm doing, but I can't tell the OM no. We'll see how it goes. One thing's for sure, I'm glad to be leaving this place. I've been in the bush for 6 weeks before getting some R&R here in Saigon. I don't want to go back, so I'm having them treat me for dysentery. Ask the OM what that is, ha-ha. All I had to do was eat some of the restaurant food in this town and got the symptoms. Anyway, that's all for now. I'm safe, and I'll be home soon. So get those crab traps out of the shed. Love, Michael.
She folded the letter carefully and put it away.
The O.M.? Bosch asked.
The old man.
Right. Her composure was coming back. Her face was taking on the hard look Bosch had seen the first day he met her. Her eyes dropped from his face to his chest and his arm in the blue sling.